This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hello, I'm Dean Beck, and welcome to The Informer. On the program tonight, times, they are a-changing at the Victorian AIDS Council. What are the organisation's expectations regarding the potentially transformative outcomes of pre-exposure prophylaxis? How will VAC manage the demands placed upon their resources as they expand their reach into regional Victoria and South Australia? And just what do they intend to do with the $15 million cash that's currently sitting in the bank following the sale of their headquarters? Shortly, the newly elected president of the Victorian AIDS Council will join us live in the studio. And this evening, over 100,000 homeless people will be sleeping rough right across Australia. How many of them are LGBTI youth? The answer will shock you. If you want to be informed, stay with us. Last night, the Victorian AIDS Council held a board meeting to elect a new president following the abrupt departure of former president Greg Carter. With high expectations over the transformative nature of PrEP, great demands on the organisation and their resources following an expansion into regional Victoria and South Australia, and with $15 million in the bank following the sale of their South Yarra headquarters, what lays ahead for the Victorian AIDS Council? Their new president is Chad Hughes, who joins us for this edition of The Informer. Chad, welcome.
Thank you, Dean. It's an honour to be on The Informer and also an honour to take on the reins as the president of the Victorian AIDS Council at this point in time.
Yeah, it's a busy time for the organisation. What are your expectations for VAC moving forward?
It's a really exciting time for the organisation and for, you know, the response to HIV. As you know, the new research that comes out brings us, you know, to the forefront with new biomedical technologies, and we need to be at the front to respond to those in terms of PrEP, understanding what it means to have undetectable viral load, the START study, which shows that it's beneficial to start ARV treatments as soon as diagnosis of being HIV positive. And so for the organisation at this point in time, with all this new evidence coming forth, it's really giving us new elements to add to our toolkit, you know, in on top of behaviour change and condoms, to sort of take us into the future.
If we can put those that are at risk on PrEP, and if we can treat those who have HIV and get them tested and get them on treatment early, in a very short space in time, we can potentially stop all new infections.
Yeah, I think
that's the theory.
Well, the theory. They're extremely exciting, you know, pieces of technology, these new biomedical interventions that we have, and VAC's been at the forefront, really working with a range of stakeholders here in Victoria and more broadly in Australia to ensure that this knowledge translates into practice and that our constituents and our community get access to PrEP and access to these technologies as quickly as possible. At the outset, yes, we are beginning to see, hopefully, a drop in incidence in HIV in this state.
There's been rumours about new figures coming forward that might indicate that.
I wouldn't necessarily call it a trend at this point, right, but it looks positive.
Okay.
We'd have to watch these things over a period of time to call it a trend and to know that it's heading more permanently in the right direction. I'd say PrEP and getting people on treatment early and getting them undetectable and their viral load is going to have a big impact.
There's not been much said about VAC taking on board Bendigo and the CAN office, nor its expansion into South Australia and picking up the slack from the collapse of the AIDS organisation there. What is happening on that front, and is it going to place VAC's resources under further pressure?
Look, at this point in time, VAC is in an extremely strong position in terms of, you know, the quality of the staff and the programs that we have, the senior management team, the CEO, the board, and has a lot to offer. In recent years, as you know, we've really had a focus on metropolitan Melbourne, and it's often discussed at the board that we need to reach out more to our communities in rural Victoria, and that we also had something to offer to the communities over in South Australia and elsewhere. So we're taking that on board. I don't think it's going to be a strain on our resources. The organisation runs really on, you know, the amazing work of the volunteers and of the staff. And without the volunteers and the staff, we wouldn't be able to expand.
And certainly in part, those expansions have been funded by government as well, haven't
they? They have, of course. That's correct.
So it's going to mean greater penetration of the VAC brand right across our southern seaboard.
Yeah, so already we have, you know, the VAC Country sort of brand coming out in rural Victoria with some amazing, you know, behaviour change and IAC materials coming up around that. The presence there also in South Australia, some great work starting there with our partners across the border. So yes, it does expand the VAC brand, but more importantly, it expands the great work of the organisation and allows other people to benefit from the knowledge and the skills that have been garnered within the organisation over the last...
The Victorian AIDS Council has a history of presidents rapidly departing the organisation. Is there anything that we should be concerned about regarding Greg Carter's recent exit?
No, Greg's been volunteering at the Victorian AIDS Council for a very long time, for many years. He made a great contribution to the organisation, both in terms of volunteering in the early days and then his role on the board and more recently as the president. I think for Greg, at this point in time, it was the right time for him, for personal reasons, to step aside and hand over the reins, and hence here I am.
You have quite a pedigree as far as the public health response to HIV is concerned, and have worked overseas or on overseas responses to HIV. You bring your experience with the Burnet Institute to the Victorian AIDS Council. How can we as a community benefit from the knowledge that you have?
Yeah, my experience is about 15 years working on addressing the HIV epidemic, mostly in resource-poor settings. I had not, until recently, been involved with the domestic scene. I came really to VAC around the time of the AIDS conference. It was here in Melbourne a couple of years ago, and I saw the work that the organisation was doing and the rebranding that they'd undertaken and the profile. And I thought, this is an exciting time to get involved and to offer some of my skills to my community back here in my hometown, where I've grown up and lived my whole life. So, yeah, I'm able to bring a broad skill set, but really work with a really strong team and capitalise on their skills as well.
There is great anticipation within the community as to what VAC will do with the finances that it now finds itself aflush with. Yeah. And some of those expectations are about a broader community engagement. Mm. Is there any indication as to timelines and as to what we can expect?
We're going through a real visioning process at the moment. As you know, we sold the building in Claremont Street after a serious piece of work last year, and then obviously we're time bound in terms of looking at where the organisation needs to move to. So the visioning is around what are the needs of the organisation and our beneficiaries at this point in time, and what we may need in terms of a facility. But also we have to look to the future, maybe 3-5 years down the track, look at scenarios where maybe HIV is reduced in incidence, and what does that mean. And in doing so, VAC's been expanding that skills to reach out to the broader community, to trans people, to gay and bisexual women, to everyone who's living with HIV, and looking at what the future might hold for an organisation with our skills. So that scenario mapping and that visioning process we're going through at the moment, and that will inform very much our decisions around where we go next and how we use those assets that we
have. How much interaction will the community have into what that future looks like? Will there be a consultation process?
The process is very much going to be consultative in terms of the staff, current beneficiaries of the organisation, and then other stakeholders working in the sector, both in terms of HIV but also in the LGBTI space, and, you know, looking at all options at this point in time.
And I know that Victoria's Sex and Gender Commissioner Rowena Allen has been eyeballing that 15 mil for quite some time. There is talk of a Pride Centre. Is there any discussion as to the integration of that for the community and whether VAC will play a part in that role?
Yeah, as I said, we're looking at all options. We first and foremost have to look to what the needs are of our beneficiaries, of the people who currently get services from VAC, to look at what the needs of the epidemic might be in the coming years. Although exciting things like PrEP may take down the incidence, with all infectious diseases, if you turn your eye off the ball for a short period of time, they can come back. So there's always going to be a role for an organisation like VAC to keep working with the community, and we need to focus on that as our primary goal.
Joy 94.9 will need a new home at some stage in the near future too. I'm sure there'll be some knocking on your door to see if there might be a small corner in the shed, wherever the shed may end up. What do you personally want to get out of this role as president of the organisation?
I've got a lot to offer, and I put my hand up for the role because I see the strengths in the team, both in the board, in the staff, in the volunteers. I see the organisation's already doing amazing things. The big challenge for us, yes, is where do we go to next? I've been involved in a lot of strategic planning and sort of visioning processes before through my other work, so I think I can contribute that. It's an exciting time to be involved with really good, strong organisation doing some amazing work. And it's exciting, and it's exciting times in terms of new technologies and new ways forward in addressing not just HIV but broader health issues in our community too.
Well, just less than 24 hours after being elected, Chad Hughes, thank you very much for joining us on The Informer.
Thank you, Dean.
Chad Hughes is the new president of the Victorian AIDS Council, joining us here on Joy 94.9's The Informer. You are on The Informer. The measure of a society is found in how they treat their weakest and most helpless citizens. Jimmy Carter said that, former US president. Interestingly enough, some 40% of homeless youth in the United States are LGBTI. But what does that mean here in Australia? Well, in a report done by David Lewis for RN's Background Briefing, he investigated what the situation was with our LGBTI youth here in Australia. David Lewis joins us. Thanks for making yourself available.
Good to be with you.
David, LGBTI youth seem to be, in this country, just like in the US, overrepresented in our homeless youth.
Yeah, that's certainly what homelessness support services will say. That study you mentioned in the US painted a pretty alarming picture of the situation there, suggesting that up to 40% of young homeless people in America are homeless. Now, clearly, there's no way that 40% of all young people in America are LGBTIQ. So clearly the cohort is overrepresented there. And a similar study in the UK put the figure at about 25%. And homelessness support services here in Australia don't have any concrete data to back this up, but they see those studies as being a pretty accurate reflection of what they're witnessing, at least anecdotally.
Sadly, these young people tend to have been abused homophobically. They often are abused sexually. They've been bullied at school. They've had a pretty tough time of it.
Yeah, I spoke to dozens of young LGBTI people who are homeless, as well as heterosexual kids who are homeless. And it's interesting, there are so many different causes of homelessness, and more often than not, it's a combination of factors that results in a young person being on the street. But as far as LGBTI young people are concerned, their sexuality and their gender identity, if it wasn't the sole cause of them becoming homeless, it was a factor that exacerbated the problems they were having at home and at school and ultimately contributed to them becoming homeless. So it is sad to speak to young people who say that they've more or less ended up on the street because they weren't accepted for who they are, which is shocking, I think, as our society becomes more diverse and more tolerant of LGBTI people, more welcoming, that this sort of thing still happens. In fact, Sherry Brunhout from Melbourne City Mission leads a team of counsellors whose job it is to keep families together, and they're often sitting in rooms with a young person who is on the verge of becoming homeless, and they have to listen to parents actually say, "I just don't understand why my child's not identifying with their biological sex," or, "I don't understand my child's sexuality. I don't want them in the house anymore. In fact, I disown them," essentially. So it is really disturbing to learn that that's still happening, and happening reasonably often if you chat to homelessness support services, who say that they're dealing with lots of LGBTI young people coming through their doors.
What's the intersection between religion and the fact that these kids are on the streets? Because many of these support organisations are religious-based. Does that create problems?
Yeah, I believe about two-thirds of homelessness support services in New South Wales are faith-based organisations. It really depends on who you speak to as to whether those organisations are providing a safe space for young LGBTI people. I mean, studies have found that even if discrimination isn't real, it can be perceived, right? So a young person may just notice incorrect terminology being used. So it could be something as simple as someone at a homelessness support service asking a woman if they have a boyfriend instead of asking, do you have a partner? And that can leave that person with the view that perhaps being a lesbian or bisexual is not accepted at that organisation. Or it could be something more practically problematic, like not having any appropriate bathroom facilities for transgender or intersex people. Or it could just be completely overt discrimination, where people are targeted for being different, either by staff or other people that they're sharing a refuge with. So the discrimination can be real or imagined. It's certainly happening. I think about a third of homelessness support services have a policy statement that goes directly to LGBTI people or talks about that group and ways to accommodate them. So that means two-thirds don't have such a statement. I mean, I speak to people like Alex Greenwich, who's the independent member for Sydney in the New South Wales Parliament and is gay himself. He actually thinks that faith-based organisations are doing a really good job. The on-the-ground workers who actually deal with these kids are accepting, are welcoming, and perhaps are a lot further away from the religious leadership of those organisations. But when I spoke to some young people, they all had stories to tell about approaching certain services and feeling discriminated or being outright rejected. So I think there's still a long way to go in terms of tackling that problem. One solution is the Rainbow Tick, which has been developed by Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria. Dr. Liam Leonard is the director there, and he has developed this system, which is a formal accreditation system that organisations can go through to get the Rainbow Tick to signal to young LGBTI people that their place is safe for them. And about 10 organisations have that Rainbow Tick at the moment, and one of those organisations is Uniting Care, which is actually a provider of aged care facilities in New South Wales and is also a faith-based organisation. So even faith-based organisations are seeing a need to cater for LGBTI people and are showing an interest in initiatives like the Rainbow Tick.
You only have to walk some 50 metres out the front door of this very radio station to find homeless people in a doorway or sitting on the streets begging. This is something that 5 years ago did not exist. What's going on, do you think?
It's really hard to say. I mean, homelessness is still a massive problem in this country, despite all those big, bold promises we've heard we've had from politicians past, like Bob Hawke, who said that no child would be living in poverty by 1990, or Kevin Rudd, who said that he wanted to halve homelessness by 2020. Those goals are not being met. Those targets are not being met. I mean, you would think that as gay and lesbian people become more visible in the community and more accepted in the community at large, that problems like this would not be occurring as often. But homelessness support services are saying that they feel that discrimination toward trans people is the new wave or the new sort of frontier in the battle for tolerance and diversity and equality. Trans people in particular seem to be vulnerable to homelessness. But again, because all the 1,500 or so homelessness support services are not currently required to provide details to the Specialist Homelessness Services Collection, which is like a national database that contains anonymous details about everyone who approaches a homelessness support service. So because those questions aren't being asked, you know, is the client gay, lesbian or bisexual, is the client transgender or intersex, there's no concrete data to tell us whether or not this problem is on the rise or on the fall or if it's just flatlining. We don't really know. So we're kind of relying on the anecdotal evidence that you're talking about, which is not really sufficient. The homelessness services themselves say that it would be very easy to introduce those questions.
Right.
There are only two more boxes to tick on a form when somebody comes into a homelessness support service. Most of these services, specifically the ones that, you know, cater exclusively to LGBTI young people, know how to have that conversation in a sensitive way. There is some concern from certain service providers that asking someone about their sexuality or their gender identity is taboo or something that could be incredibly private. And sure, if people are struggling to come to terms with that, it might be a sensitive area. But in my experience speaking to these young homeless kids, they've got nothing to hide about their identity. Some simple training or, you know, even... something much less formal than the rainbow tick could be introduced to help organisations phrase the question in such a way that doesn't cause offence. Alex Greenwich, again, would like to see some of the resources used in safe schools to be expanded to the homelessness sector so that people can become a bit more literate, if you like, in approaching LGBTI clients.
The US report also discovered that these youth are far more likely to have alcohol and drug issues, mental health issues, and to have gone to sex work to pay for life. Did you encounter any of that in filing your report for Radio National?
Absolutely. I met with one young transgender woman, Josie, 18 years old. Josie came from country New South Wales, had a really tough upbringing as a child. She was drawn to her mother's wardrobe and to girls' toys and actually started wearing dresses to school where she was bullied significantly. There was some violence in the family home, so eventually Josie decided enough was enough and she moved to Sydney, but has really been struggling to find shelter ever since. And, you know, as you can imagine, coming from such a traumatic background, Josie doesn't really have much respect for authority, and that's led to some behavioural issues that's resulted in her being kicked out of refuges, and she's really having a tough time kind of discovering who she is, but also maturing into adulthood. As a result of that, she's had some pretty desperate times where she's not had anywhere to sleep, she's not had any money, and she did turn to sex work and actually found a bit of a community as a result of doing that, which might sound strange, but she came across dozens of trans women who were, you know, working the streets in King's Cross and Darlinghurst every night. Those women taught her how to sell her body and how to use her body to make money. A lot of those women were using the drug ICE as well, so that was introduced to Josie, who describes it as being sort of source of adrenaline, but it also, she said, made time move a lot quicker. During those days when she had nothing to do, time would fly if she was using ice, and it would also make the shifts she was working as a sex worker at night fly by a lot quicker as well. So, yeah, I mean, it seems to be a pretty well-worn path, regrettably, the sex work and the drug use. Josie says she's not using drugs anymore. She stopped doing sex work as well when she found a partner, but that relationship since fallen apart, so who knows, the pressure might still be there to return to sex work.
David, this is your first report for Background Briefing. How long did it take you to put together?
It took 6 weeks, roughly kind of 2 weeks of research, followed by 2 weeks of travelling around and spending time in refuges and drop-in centres and homeless shelters and even on the streets with some young people and trying to really get a sense of what life is like for them. And then we spend the final 2 weeks of that period, you know, madly scripting and editing and putting the thing to air. It sounds like a long period of time for most journalists who are used to filing every, you know, half hour or every minute seemingly these days. The more you learn about a topic, the more you realise there is to learn, I think. You know, I could have disappeared into this area for a much longer period of time because there are so many unanswered questions. It's a very complicated issue. There's so much to be explored here, including public housing and government's response to that, and what happens when these people, these kids, actually manage to rise above homelessness in the most desperate sense, that is living on the streets, what support is available to them to help them find a job and get education. And you know, it's a really long and difficult and complicated journey that these young people are on. It's definitely one that we should be paying attention to as reporters, I think.
Well, congratulations on your debut for Background Briefing. Thank you very much for joining us on The Informer today.
Thanks for having me.
David Lewis's full investigation is available on RN's Background Briefing. You can, of course, keep up to date with all of the stories that we're covering by following the program on Twitter at The Informer Joy. Dean Beck with you on Joy 94.9's brand new current affairs program, The Informer. Time for us now to cross to the UK. Pinknews.co.uk's senior multi-platform journalist Bobby Ray joins us. Bobby, I believe Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is taking his clothes off, or is he?
Well, I'm unfortunately sad to say he won't be taking his clothes off. Sadly, the Daily Mail and Russia Today got their facts wrong and got caught by our April Fool's joke.
An April Fool's Day joke that went international, thanks to Pink News.
It did go international, yes. Not only did it go international, it was translated into French for all the people in France to read the story. At least with Russia Today, they were a bit sceptical. They reported it as a true story, but they put one line at the end to say it may be an April Fool's Day joke. However, the Mail Online ran the story as a true story until their US editor noticed that it was an April Fool's Day joke and quickly had them correct it.
Some sub-editors there who are in trouble, I am sure. Now, you've got a story on some local Indigenous stuff here in Australia.
Yes, this will be the one for the Australian audience will like, that Outback grass is apparently the best material to make condoms from.
Outback grass?
Outback grass, yes. So the grass kind of sprouts out all over Outback in Australia has been found to actually be the best for making condoms. So some research has been done at the University of Queensland. They've been testing a number of different substances and fibres and have found that the grass from the Outback is actually the strongest, most durable, and can make a range of what they call super condoms.
How flexible is this grass, I wonder?
It says, according to what we've seen from the research, it is actually fairly durable. So it's obviously used by hunters for a number of years. Aboriginal hunters used it before, and that's why I believe they kind of decided to test it.
One wonders what they were hunting. And finally, in our roundup, what's your most clicked story this week?
So the most kind of clicked story we've had this week is a young girl from here in the UK who received a rather homophobic text message from her aunt who said, "Don't worry, you don't have to be bisexual. You'll find a man one day, but I hope you don't spoil your cousin's birthday." To which the girl replied, "Oh, well, I can't actually make her birthday because I'm going off to a massive lesbian orgy. Divorce, by the way, because I've seen your husband's new girlfriend and she looks a lot younger than you."
Oh.
So that was a tweet that was shared, a text message exchange between the girl and her aunt, and that seemed to go viral, and a lot of people are kind of applauding the girl for standing up to her homophobic aunt.
Well, Bobby Ray, thank you very much for joining us on this debut edition of Wednesday Night's Informer. Appreciate your time today.
No problem. Thanks very much.
Bobby Ray is the senior multi-platform journalist for pinknews.co.uk. And that's it for my edition of The Informer this Wednesday evening. A very big thank you to Chad Hughes, the brand new president of the Victorian AIDS Council, and to David Lewis. You can check out his report for ABC Radio National's background briefing on LGBTI youth. I recommend that you do. It's a very, very good report. And also thanks to Bobby Ray from Pink News in the United Kingdom. Don't forget, you can tune into The Informer four nights a week here on Joy 94.9 from 6:30 p.m. It is Joy 94.9's brand new current affairs program. Follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy, and you can follow me on Twitter at Dean Beck on Air. From me, that's it. Until next time, keep well, take care. Bye-bye.
Joy 94.9. Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.